is building community, building spaces for people to come and feel, you know, empowered and like challenged and educate themselves on a new area and find community and collectiveness and solidarity in an environment where they are, you know, kind of stretching themselves and going out of their comfort zone. I guess that's where I've kind of found purpose, at least for the time being, is I don't believe in an afterlife. I don't believe in a soul. I don't believe in a kind of pre or post life experience.
Okay.
I do think that humans are incredibly complicated meat robots. People are extracting unbelievable value from your labor, and you're all in the same fucking boat about it. Part of me is very much just on the argument that, like, it's unsustainable. It maybe we last another 10 years, maybe another 50, maybe 150. But fundamentally, this system of some own and everyone else runs off the scraps is unsustainable. And eventually, the bread and circus will not distract people enough, and we will...
I believe the root problem of what we're dealing with in the world... especially since 1971, is we have a... the world is using fake money.
Okay.
Money which is inherently broken.
After we moved off the gold.
Fuck it, let's kick it off.
Hello.
Hello, welcome.
Thank you.
It's, yeah, I don't know. I don't know where we would like to take it, you know, because I've written down some ideas and stuff, but maybe...
I love that, yeah.
I'll start first with this. Please... say whatever you'd like to say about yourself to introduce yourself to our listeners, because we've not had you on the show
yet. My name's Ronan Foley. I am a jiu-jitsu coach. I've been a brown belt. I've been doing it very, very long time, 13, 14 years now. Jiu-jitsu is my full-time gig, so I'm teaching all the time. In my personal life, I like to, you know, play games and watch anime, classic jiu-jitsu kind of guy. Staying busy with work as much as I can on that. Had some kind of health stuff last year, which has been kind of fun. Often people will ask me questions about that. I had cancer last year, but got rid of it, got over it, no biggie.
No biggie.
that's me. You know, that's me. I'm a very, you know, I also am very interested in, like, politics and all that kind of stuff, if that's somewhere you like to go with conversation. Obviously, it's a very interesting time to be interested in.
I'm pretty sure ever since we came to life, like, we're fairly similar in age. It's an interesting time.
Yeah, the last 30-ish years have been pretty spicy. So yeah, that's me. What about you?
That's awesome. Hello, and welcome. My name is Wojtek. What about me? You know, why I asked this, and we're going to take the conversation wherever we want to take it, but I've had an interview, a conversation with my supervisor from uni the other week, and we started exploring what do we say about ourselves, right? Who are you? Who am I? As we just discussed before we started rolling, like, I could say I'm an auditor because that's what I do for a job. I could say I'm a husband because I have a wife. I could say I'm a son because I have parents, right? Yeah, and I assume you do too.
Oh yeah, two of them. I know.
Crazy. So, but it is interesting, right? How do we introduce ourselves to people? And I don't know if that's the case for your experience, but Alistair mentioned that apparently it's very unique for the UK and the US to be asking one of the initial questions, what do you do?
Oh, really? I didn't know this.
I don't know. Is that what you've...
I mean, it's very, very normal. It's like probably in the first three questions you'd ask someone, like...
How old are you?
Right? Those are probably the three things you ask people kind of off rip. When you're trying to make polite conversation.
Yeah, but when you're trying to just pass the time of awkwardness.
When you don't really want to know.
Yeah,
it is strange, isn't it? Like, I think it's also interesting how other people can immediately prescribe those kind of things to you as well. Like, the idea of, like, master statuses is right. Like, you can have all these identities and statuses that kind of are who you are and how you describe yourself and how you view yourself. But then some people can get statuses that overwhelm all others and can become kind of something that, oh, thank you, everyone kind of sees kind of presently and immediately and by your very nature. And, you know, obviously things like kind of sex and race can be things like this, but then also you get interesting kind of versions of that where like you could be a husband and an auditor, but if you commit a crime, you're a criminal, right? Like, yeah, and that's right. Now just your status forever, and there's nothing you can do about that. And the way other people kind of view all those other things about you can be shaped by this one other thing that kind of is true about you as well. I think the way people view you is and the way you view yourself can be very complicated at times.
Yeah, it's curious, right? So like, for example, let's say for the benefit of the podcast, as we started chatting, yeah, that's what I do supposedly, but for the most part why we're here is I've come across you because you're my coach at Jiu-Jitsu, right?
Yeah.
By now, I know you much more than just through the lens of he knows how to do things that I'm trying to learn. But for someone out there listening, I can be for them whoever they want me to be, right? Like in every conversation I have as well, I guess a good conversation demands of us both to try to dance together, and if you want to take it to the politics, we're gonna dance politics, right? And if someone else wants to go philosophy, we're gonna dance philosophy. So it is interesting. It's in a way, actually, do you play chess?
Badly.
But you do play games,
sure,
like
yeah.
quite complex games, because I know during your time in... in I guess rehab is
treatment,
a good way to put it.
Treatment.
You've played a lot of games that for me are like completely bonkers, complex, right?
Spreadsheet games. I love a spreadsheet game.
What do you mean by that?
Like a game that you can't play without a spreadsheet on your second monitor.
You actually have a spreadsheet.
I mean, there's a few, and also you know like third party apps that help you like plan and design stuff and like.
Can you name a few?
Yeah, so I play a lot of kind of like grand strategy, like map games, which I feel like is very archetypical. Like, you know, your Total Wars and your Civilizations and stuff like
that.
Okay. And then I play a lot of Path of Exile as well, which has got like a whole custom built, like basically it's a giant spreadsheet that people use to plan out their characters and stuff, and that's great. At the minute, I'm playing a lot of Slay the Spire, which has just come out.
What is it?
It's like a roguelike deck building game, and oh my god, it's crack cocaine. I can't put it down, it's insane. Strongly recommend that one for anyone.
Okay, we'll put the links there. So, but my point was, those games, similar to Jiu-Jitsu, I would argue, demand of you a certain level of complex critical thinking. Even though that on the base layer, it just looks like you're having fun, right?
Yeah.
Or you're unserious about fighting, so you sit down and start making weird moves.
Yeah.
So, I guess...
I think it's normal, though. Like, I think there's a couple ways of, like, entertaining yourself, right? One is challenging and pushing and trying to, like... always trying to find a problem and solve it. Solving problems is inherently fun. People have always loved solving problems. You know, Rubik's cubes are just putting the same bits of color on one side of a box, and like people find it endlessly entertaining. You know, people love to solve problems, and not always. You know, sometimes people just want to watch some trashy TV and turn their brain off and relax after a long day, and that's totally fine as well. Right, I totally get that. But I think for me, I've always found that I like. Challenge, and I like challenge in my work, and I like challenge in my hobbies, and I like challenge in my recreation as well, and obviously varying degrees of challenge. You know, I'm not one of those guys who like loves to just suffer for like 40 hours and then beat someone. Like a Dark Souls fan, have you played any of the Dark Souls games? Oh my god, I have a friend who loves them, and they're just, you know, they're just do the same thing like 400 times and just losing until you finally understand it, and then you win. And I imagine the endorphins are amazing, but I can't sit and endure the same monotonous task so much. I like a slightly less intense level of challenge, something that's, you know, achievable every now and again. But yeah, I think people just enjoy to challenge themselves, and I think that's a really great way to kind of rest and recuperate. I guess someone said to me a long time ago, like, a change is as good as a rest. Yeah, you've probably heard that.
A change is as good as a rest.
Yeah. And I think there's something to that. You know, like, I'm always problem solving at work. You know, if someone comes to me and is like, hey, I want to do a private, like, I keep getting stuck in half guard, you know, like, that is problem solving. I'm literally going, I'm watching them doing, or I'm feeling them doing, I'm going, oh, try this, try this, try this, and we problem solve it together. And then I go home and I do problem solving in a different way. You know, I go and play video games or like I do something. I'm not a big like just a, you know, sit and watch mindless TV or just for entertainment kind of thing. If I want to watch media, I want it to like challenge me again. I want it to like make me think a bit or at least be cool.
Yeah, I do wonder though, is that something that you've always been? Because you mentioned before we started rolling that you barely have any, let's say, expenses on a broader, in a sense that you just mentioned that you do a lot of complex problem solving, and yet in some areas of life you keep it as simple as possible.
Yeah.
Is that something that you got out of like your house, or is it your character? You know, do your siblings have the same? I assume not.
Yeah, exactly. My siblings are all. They have very different goals to me, but they're both quite straightforward people. You know, neither of them are like grinding really hard to get luxuries and a fast car and nice clothes and stuff. They're just really living life, pursuing their own goals that are quite kind of distinct. You know, none of us have the kind of traditional measures of success that you'd see in a typical consumer society. Where
let's say contemporary.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think. Yeah, I guess maybe there's probably some element of it that was my parents. My parents aren't particularly materialistic in their lives either, especially my mum. She's very much about like character and individual like self-set goals and stuff, and much less about marked signs of achievement that we could recognise in a kind of contemporary social world. So I guess it probably comes from that. Yeah, it probably comes from mum being very much like, listen, set your own goals, find something that works for you, and dad as well. And find something that like really fills you up and makes you feel content and fulfilled, and pursue that. But yeah, again, like I guess to kind of circle back then as well, I don't find the challenge of like making really nice food. I don't find that to be a satisfying challenge. I don't like to cook. I don't care. Like when I was younger, I was dabbling with, maybe I'll try cooking. Maybe I'll try cook this. What do I like? And I'd cook different things and stuff. And I'd spend like an hour in the kitchen making like a fancy meal for me, by my standards. And I'd eat it and I go, it's fine. It's all right. Or I go out to a restaurant and I pay 80 quid for a fancy meal. And I'm like, it's okay, I guess, but also, when me and my girlfriend recently, after the whole cancer thing, were able to actually go over to Costa Rica because we have a kind of family connection out there, so we were able to stay for cheap,
wow,
which was amazing, 2 weeks out there. But that was like brilliant for me because it was rice and beans for breakfast, it was rice and beans for lunch, and we were living
no fruits, no nothing.
Well, there was lots of fruit. Yeah, I mean, Costa Rica was incredible for that. But like as the base, it was just very straightforward, simple food, and that was great for me because I'm, for all the effort it takes to make something fancy, I just don't enjoy it that much. So I think that's a challenge. I just don't find it enjoyable.
It's interesting. I was gonna ask like, how do you then, you and Phoebe, how do you spend time if you don't go to restaurants? What do you do in your spare time together? And you're not watching mindless TV, I assume.
Sometimes she's watching mindless TV and I'll join
you're
her. You're participating. Yeah, or I like watch something on my phone and that sort of thing. But we found a really great rhythm. Phoebe's great. She really enjoys something I enjoy, which is like parallel play sort of thing, right? So she can be reading her book or watching her show, and I can be on my phone or playing a game or reading my book, and it feels very connected, and we're spending quality time together, but we don't necessarily have to be doing the same thing. Obviously, there's kind of a lot of overlap. There's a lot of kind of shows that I find really enjoyable that she also enjoys, and we sometimes watch those, and then we finish them and we go, okay, back to our separate things. Early on when we were dating, I was playing a role-playing Dungeons & Dragons sort of based game,
sure,
like Baldur's Gate 3 on the computer. And she'd come over and sometimes I'd like show it to her and she'd be like, oh, that's kind of cool. She's big into her kind of reading and stuff. And she was like, oh, that's really quite cool, actually. Can I have a go? And then she would play a little bit. And then she got really, really into it. So into it, actually, that we built her a computer out of some of the spare parts I had from previous builds.
So we can play together. Yeah.
So that's a great way that we kind of get to spend quality time together. We can play stuff together. And then it's kind of, and then even if we're not necessarily playing the same game together, you know, we're sat near each other in the same room doing a similar thing, not like so focused that you can't have like a discussion, but also not so kind of like together that you have to be doing the exact same thing. It works really well. And I don't think I think I'm very lucky with Phoebe in that she is so okay with that kind of like, hey, yeah, we can do the same thing or the different things at the same time. In the same space, and that's still very connecting for her, which works great for me, so that's ideal.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, because like my first thought when you mentioned that you do different things at the same time, like the horror scenario that I imagine is when I see people at the restaurant, for example, in their phones. Like we're having a meal together, but each of us is basically, you know, sucked into this other black mirror, right?
Yeah, it's not... Obviously, every now and again...
You have to balance it. But it, as you said earlier...
it works great, yeah.
If it works for you, it works, right?
Exactly. And every now and again, we'll do, like, a date night. And, like, for the other week, we went and watched a movie. And we went and watched Project Hail Mary, which was really cool. I enjoyed that. And then we went and had a little dinner afterwards, and it was cool. But, you know, I guess the kind of... The point I was trying to make there is that my... For food especially, the value proposition just never feels right for me. Like, spending 20 quid on a meal where I'm like, meh, it's calories. You know, it's like, but it's just different for Phoebe. And obviously she enjoys food. She gets a lot of joy out of trying different foods and, you know, the food she likes and going out and getting nice food. And that's cool. So we can, I can obviously on board with supporting her in that. But it doesn't really do much for me.
So let's... explore a bit deeper, because you know we sort of touched on the whole, like, I guess a value proposition from your perspective of what's important for you in life and stuff. And I know you've not talked about this yet on the podcast. I try to not to repeat whatever you've already explored. What do you think? What do you perceive it for your life to be? You know. On whatever level you would want to describe it, like the point, let's say what gets you out of bed in the morning, and I don't mean because I have to get up and my go alarm. To work, or having to feed the cat. Like, because we're at this stage, you're slightly younger than me, but still, we've done a little bit of adulting so far. You already have a career in the sphere that you actually enjoy, which, you know, is commendable.
Lucky.
What do you think it's all about? Like, or what do you want it to be about going forward?
Yeah, I think when I was younger, I really wanted to, like, make a difference in a macro sense, you know, like really change the world. But I think everyone's kind of like that.
Messianic,
phase. Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if that's really plausible. I think the thing for me is, like, I want to improve the lives of people around me. That's, like, at a basic level. And I don't know, like, I think there's so much profound suffering and inequality and difficulty in people's lives that I have kind of not specialized in solving. You know, I've kind of missed the window now on being that guy who kind of solves that front. And so I think an area that I feel like I can kind of be very involved in at this current stage of my life is building community, building spaces for people to come and feel, you know, empowered and like challenged and educate themselves on a new area and find community and collectiveness and solidarity in an environment where they are, you know, kind of stretching themselves and going out of their comfort zone. I guess that's where I've kind of found purpose, at least for the time being, is in building spaces where people can kind of in creating those third spaces that people talk about so often these days, you know, it's spaces that aren't education, work, or the home, and that are something you do for fun, and you do with other people, and you do that brings meaning and joy and challenge and social connection in a space outside the home and work. And so I guess facilitating and creating that is my purpose at the moment. I'm very much in the kind of existentialist school of thought when it comes to like purpose broadly. I'm not a kind of divine ordained purpose guy. I'm not a I'm not a true nihilist. You know, I'm very much of the opinion that we create our own purpose and there is no meaning. You have to find meaning. And you have to cling onto it with everything you've got. And you've got to like build your own purpose in life and then follow that. I don't think there is some kind of reason we're all here. I think you have to find and create that yourself. And I think that's empowering. I think that's good. I think that gives you a lot of liberty and freedom within that, you know?
Do you think there was life before this or there will be life after? In whatever sense you want to...
Like in a solipsistic way?
Let's say, do you perceive that we are here and then once we're gone, we're gone?
Yes. I am a materialist in that regard. I don't believe in an afterlife. I don't believe in a soul. I don't believe in a kind of pre or post life experience.
Okay.
I do think that humans are incredibly complicated meat robots.
Okay.
And I really don't believe in a kind of transcendental soul or anything like that. I think it's a really nice and compelling idea. That there is something, but I fear that it's a fear response in opposition to this almost egoistic sense that like my life is everything to me. How could this incredible, wonderful, fulfilling experience that I have, like inside my head, is so complex? How could this just end? I feel like it's kind of an ego project. Mm. It's like. Yeah, but like to the fucking octopus or dolphin, like they've got incredibly complex inner worlds as well, we assume, and to some degree. Like your inner world is just as complex to mine, but like if you died tomorrow, it wouldn't be a crushing, shattering reduction of my like lived experience as a sensory being.
Sure.
It would just be like, oh, they're not here anymore. But that is like an entire universe collapsing. Right?
Mm.
And similarly, if I died tomorrow, 99.99% of all the people in the world wouldn't give a hoot. But like, obviously some people would be a bit bummed, but they'd get over it. Whereas to me, it's like this ending of a sensory world, a unique, incredible, divine spark of radiance is my existence. And it just goes. And I think that there really is, because it feels so huge, for us as individuals experiencing life, we just struggle to reconcile with the fact that all this sensory experience has been evolved to serve us in reproducing and to continue our kind of evolutionary line, and that this is just all this kind of all this sensory data is just in service of that, and that's why, and it has evolved to be this complex or by happenstance. And it can't just go away, and that's fine. I really think it's an ego project to be like, no, my world's so complicated it couldn't just end. I think it can. Mm. I think it can. I think that's scary, and it's uncomfortable, and it's unpleasant. But also, I would much rather a horrible, unpleasant lie than a comfort. A horrible, unpleasant truth than a comforting lie. You know,
yeah,
I just think it's. Yeah,
that's you know, it's quite telling and powerful to hear from you, especially because you've had at least some moment to consider it more seriously than, like, don't get me wrong, every now and then I do think I think it's beneficial to think about death as
sure.
a context, let's, you know, whatever idea, but I've not had, maybe once in my life I've had a situation when I realized post fact that I could have been gone, that's curious, but in the time of it happening I was too dosed with stuff to even realize that that's the case, so I didn't really have a time to ponder.
Do you want to talk about that?
I did actually mention a while back, so I got completely blastered at a party.
Okay, wow.
And I used to longboard around my uni town, right? And there were a lot of, let's say, valleys, because it wasn't in in Wales. It was just another one of those nights. Like, I would usually go back on my longboard home.
Wow, cool.
But I was really, really, really bad.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize because I was bad. So I literally, you know, I, for whatever reason, I decided to skate down the same hill as I skated before anyway. And it demanded of you to press against the edge strong enough to turn. And for a body that is switched off because of alcohol, it just won't work.
Yeah.
And I launched myself into the street.
Oh, shit.
I left a little, you know, hole in my face. And I didn't realize until, like, I don't know, a few minutes later, skating
again. Oh, you kept going?
I mean, like, I was so destroyed that only when I realized that I'm wet with blood, that something's probably not right.
Oh, my God.
And to be honest, you know, I actually talked about it with someone recently when we discussed NHS and stuff. That experience for me in Swansea Hospital, they took care of me immediately. It was great. Like, I had to travel there. There was a bit of a bumming part about, like, I called 911 after realizing that I'm kind of bleeding. And the lady told me that because I'm calling her and because I'm able to call her, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, then they won't send the, you know, whatever, the ambulance.
Yeah.
I need to get there.
Back on the longboard.
Yeah, so I did, but then I stopped halfway through at a train station and called my friends who were at the party still, because I wasn't sure if I'm going to make it. You know, I don't know how much blood I'm losing. I'm just destroyed.
Holy shit.
And it was fine. Like, don't get me wrong. I think it was one of the best things that happened to me, in a sense that it allowed me, especially in that time, that was during COVID, funnily enough. So there was also...
That's quite recent then, sort of.
2021, yeah.
Yeah, wow.
So they, because of COVID, they didn't allow me to sit in the waiting area where I'm supposed to be sitting. So I was sat in the corridor on the floor waiting for my operation. Well, they patched me slightly, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I had the... And my phone was dead. I couldn't read, which I usually do when I'm passing time, because of the, you know, the whole rap. So I had the space to truly practice what I preached by that time about mindful dealing with what you're, you know, like, your whole body is scraped, you're in pain. You don't know if you're going to be like, okay, how am I going to look, which is a big thing, of course,
okay,
you know,
the
ego is definitely screaming. They're like, oh my God, you're going to be the nastiest man alive.
I don't know, man. A scar would go pretty hard.
I mean, yeah, like, you know, I got away with murder 100%. It was incredible, but... But yeah, it was the one time when I felt like afterwards, coming to realize that if I hit it a different angle, or maybe if I was not as sedated to bounce off of, know, you don't know what's going to happen. And it's 2 o'clock in the morning at night. No one, I could just be there. No one could care. I could bleed out. You know what I mean?
If you just knock yourself out for a bit longer,
So I kind of feel that I was given a wake-up call about, like, okay, well, maybe it's about time you sort yourself together, stop partying that much and think. And it did. I have no doubt it changed me, you know, every event does.
Is that some of the kind of lessons you took from it? Did you change much in your life, or did you?
I mean, yeah, I saw that it works. You know, the whole. So personally, and you've made your argument about the meat sack and stuff. I think we are like the material sense, the physical, let's say, an avatar, literally, but then there is the player, which is the awareness. I don't know where it goes. I have. The theory that I'm most inclined to believe, let's say, is that we are the universe experiencing itself, and so we play different roles to entertain ourselves, because we're bored, because we're omnipresent and omnipotent. And so you restrict yourself to be able to experience emotions and everything, because otherwise it would be quite boring. You know, like a game that doesn't involve any challenges?
It's
just a boring game. So... I think that there is an awareness within us, like this, you know, consciousness, let's say, the spark, which uses this and the side passenger called ego that makes us care about this And I think ego is essential for us to not be like, oh, I'm just going to sit in the puddle of my shit until I die because for I'm sure. there, you
yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah.
which some people do when they attain enlightenment. Yeah. And a big part of it, for me at least, is that if that's the case, and if I am creating my reality, but at the same time, not to say that this is not the end, rather it is more of a play than the main act. Like it made me in that moment, and coming off of it, I'm definitely wiser now than before. It just makes me feel quite good, even if it's shitty. Like,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
it doesn't take away the pain. You're still feeling the pain.
For sure, yeah.
But it does make things a bit more... I guess you get a bit more... not disassociated, but independent of what's going on.
Yeah.
Right? It can be very pleasurable, and that's great. And there is this idea, this too shall pass. In the same way, it can be unpleasant. And in both situations, what you're effectively doing is to deal with the circumstance as it appears, you can accept and let go of it,
mm-hmm.
seeing at the end it doesn't really matter. And to that, I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like to the degree that I matter to people,
yeah.
it's probably just Julia that actually gives
yeah.
a hoot,
yeah.
as you said, more than anyone else.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree entirely. Like, I'm not, like, you're almost kind of expressing, not kind of a dualism, but almost a oneism, right? Of this whole, everything is one, but there is a greater consciousness. I'm not in that camp.
Sure.
But I do very much agree that the kind of, the lived experience of piloting this meat suit should and is when kind of mindfulness and mental awareness is done well, should feel distinct, right? There should be this feeling of, well, I am experiencing what is happening to my body, right? I'm not my body, right? And I think that people who fail to make that kind of psychological distinction find themselves very often just stuck in cycles of reactivity and impulsiveness and kind of struggle with the ability to kind of self-reflect meaningfully. And so whilst I don't think that that kind of conscious pilot, if you like, is external to the body, I think it's an internal piece of ourselves, and I think it's a kind of a figment of our biological quirkiness that we have this kind of second observer state.
Sure.
I do think it's really powerful for self-development to view yourself from an internal outsider, you know, like to see yourself in the third person, to observe your own actions, to watch the way you react to things, to listen to your own thoughts and go, I'm not sure I'm enjoying the way I'm reacting to this. I don't think I should be thinking this way. I'm going to take conscious cognitive steps to think different ways, to react to stimuli differently. You know, like a classic example is when you have like trauma or something and you someone says something that you find quite distressing or upsetting. If you aren't viewing yourself as a complex system of reactions and feelings and thoughts and beliefs, and instead as this is truth, this is myself, you just react. But if you can take that time and have a think and go, okay, like they actually aren't saying that, but I'm having this reaction because of all these complicated roots and kind of network of beliefs I have, I think it empowers you to change them and take control of over your own kind of especially reactivity, but life in general. So I'm very much in that camp that it's, I think that the way you are thinking about it is a really useful and like practical way to approach kind of self-development and life, I guess. Where I disagree is the kind of the scientific or the metaphysical discussion about it. And I disagree that is reality, but I agree it's such a powerful way to conceive of the world for bettering your life. And then you can get into a semantics thing of like, well, is it really falsifiable or provable that there is a divine consciousness to the universe? Maybe not. Like, can we even like have a meaningful discussion around that if it's not falsifiable?
Yeah.
Maybe we just go with what's most useful for kind of getting through your day to day. So
how did you arrive? Because it sounds to me, and I'm pretty much convinced by now that you're going to say yes, that you've explored at least to some degree the different philosophical, you know, notions or maybe some spiritual teachings just to entertain yourself and develop. What got you into the understanding? And then I'd like you to maybe tie it to your experience of dealing with the potential of death, because I kind of explored, you know, mine, and I wonder if that was a big shift or actually a blip, because you've already been ready for it.
Yeah, I guess it kind of functioned as a blip, because I've been, my philosophical beliefs have been quite cemented for quite a while. Most of my kind of knowledge on this topic has come through traditional academic roots. You know, like I did my A-levels in philosophy, government, politics, sociology, and psychology. So like very much in this world.
Plenty.
Yeah,
I see.
A little bit of everything, a little bit of a like tapas of all the different flavors. And I did my undergraduate degree in sociology. And I've always had kind of quite a kind of philosophical end of the sociological spectrum. You know, I'm quite, you know, philosophy of government sort of thing. But weirdly, I think I could trace my interest in this topic to one YouTube video. There was one specific YouTube video of a debate on Intelligence Squared, which was this debate thing back in the day. There's just this big long YouTube video on it with like Christopher Hitchens and Stephen Fry and some conservative politician lady and an archbishop of somewhere. And they had a really interesting discussion about this kind of, like, I think the question specifically was, like, is the Catholic Church a force for good? Or something like this. And it was a very... Yeah,
that's,
right?
That's a curious... Yeah.
And so there was a lot of kind of historical discussion, kind of a fact-based discussion. There was also some kind of broader discussion about, like, is organized religion good? Is faithfulness and spirituality good? And all these different kind of blends. And I remember watching it and just being absolutely riveted and really, really, really enjoying it. And after that, and I guess, you know, before that, I did have like kind of big questions. My parents were non-religious and had kind of grievances with churches, broadly speaking.
Did you discuss it with your parents?
Yeah. And they were like, listen, you're like totally entitled to believe whatever you want, you know, do your own thinking about it, find, like, read everything you can, look at both sides, come to your own conclusions. But, you know, I think it's a load of horseshit. It was basically their kind of take on it. And so that obviously kind of biased me one way. But then I did a lot of, you know, reading on it, and I was very, very, very mindful of this kind of stuff when I was in my teenage years. Did a lot of reading of different religious texts and different philosophical discussions of the matter. And then the only reason I went into academia was to explore the kind of philosophy of religion stuff. Ended up not being where I took the whole thing, because I found that the discussion for me got pretty reductive pretty fast. You know, I kind of did Problem of Evil, and then I found none of the rebuttals compelling, and I went, right, that kind of solves that for me. I don't really need to see much more. For kind of organized religion, and then I've put my focus more into kind of more tangible, more practical kind of applications.
I assume politics became a more
politics
a better and then, outlet, because it is a religion in a sense, you know, exactly, it's subscribing to ideas. What is religion?
Just an idea.
I think a system of ideas.
I think religion seeks to explain a lot more than politics, like in kind of a macro sense, right? Like you know, neo-fascism is not making claims to the origin of the universe, you know. Well, potentially neo-fascism is a bad example, actually, because it might do, you know, but like Marxism isn't making claims in the origin of the universe, for example. So I definitely found it, you know, more hands-on and practical. What I didn't know at the time, kind of as a quirk, as a funny thing, is I was doing philosophy, which is considered a pretty hard subject at university, and I was doing political science, which is considered a relatively hard subject, not as hard as like law or history or something, but, you know, pretty tough. And then I dropped psychology because I wasn't enjoying it so much, because you only need to do 3 A-levels. And then I was like, well, sociology is great because it's got all that kind of political theory stuff, you know, discussions around functionalism, feminism, Marxism, all these kind of things. But it's also got this kind of more practical element where it's like, you know, almost blends into social policy at times. So you've got your kind of, your philosophy of law, philosophy of politics, philosophy of societies, and then you've also got your kind of, right, but how do we reduce crime in urban environments between 2001 and 2010, you know? Like, you've got the really practical elements. So I was like, sociology is this perfect blend of the two. I'll go and do sociology at uni. What I didn't know at the time is sociology is one of those degrees that you basically go and do if you're not smart enough to do government politics, oh, you know? And so I showed up and 90% of the people on my course were like, eh, I just wanted to go to uni for a party. Like, I'm just here to like, you know, have a good time. And sociology was really, really easy to get into. And I was like, what? I wanted to do it because it was kind of a blend of both. So I ended up doing a lot of kind of GovPol, social policy and philosophy modules, but still was a bit disappointed, and it kind of didn't scratch the itch I was hoping it would.
On that front, my personal experience, and I did film and TV as my undergrad, and then business and whatever accounting for masters. My perspective is it's usually 80% or 90% of people go to uni because it just sounds good.
Yeah.
Or it was easy to get to, or, you know, I want to blah, 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 whatever. Exactly. So the disappointment there, I'm pretty sure even if you were to go for like the highest level governmental politics stuff, you would still find a bunch of morons. Like,
maybe if you did like theoretical maths or some horrible,
but still, like, not in the sense that there are people that don't know why they're there, but those wouldn't be the people you would like to have a discussion with. My wife studied applied maths.
Oh wow, okay.
And like, you know, this is not to diminish whatever, but it seems, at least from our perspective, that yet again, you will get a little percentage of people who both enjoy it and are interested, and then a bigger percentage of people, maybe because they've been good at maths, they just ended up in maths. It's still, yet again, because uni is something everyone does.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me ask you this way, because you did mention earlier that you're interested in politics and stuff, and you can say whatever you'd like here, but I do wonder, after studying it and exploring, and I assume that you are following whatever is happening in the world, what is your perspective in general on, like, how can we fix what we're dealing with here? And you can unpack whichever aspect, whether it's international, local, Edinburgh, I don't know, whatever you're interested in. I'm curious.
I think, like, there's a huge part of me which is still in, like, essentially a Marxist train of thought, which is what we're seeing is we're seeing the death throes of a late-stage capitalist economy where we have survived crash after crash of capital inherently eating itself, and every time the crash seems to get more and more recurrent and more, like, a shorter kind of recovery period in between, and that as we move to this kind of hyper-consumerist, late-stage capitalism where we're and a hyper-reality, to quote some kind of Baudrillard, you've got like a society which is just deviating so massively between the owners and the bourgeois and the proletariat, right?
Like the K-shaped economy.
Yeah, the K-shaped would be a classic example, although even then, like, that's still kind of talking about like workers, right? Like people who own everything and own the mortgage on your house, own the bank that you subscribe to, own the land you live on, that there's such a massive gap between the owners and the people who have not, that this system is inherently unstable and inherently unsustainable, and that we are currently living in a well of bread and circuses where we're just distracted from the reality that whilst you argue with your neighbour over whether they should wear a fucking burqa or not, like, that people are extracting unbelievable value from your labour, and you're all in the same fucking boat about it. I part of me is very much just on the argument that, like, it's unsustainable. Maybe we last another 10 years, maybe another 50, maybe 150. But fundamentally, this system of some own and everyone else runs off the scraps is unsustainable, and eventually the bread and circus will not distract people enough, and we will look around and we'll have kicked out every immigrant, we'll have gotten rid of every queer gender identity, we will have had so much infighting between different workers groups, and eventually there will be no one left to blame apart from
ourselves,
the people who own everything, the people who extract the value from us, the people who manipulate and rule the ruling class of elites. And 15 years ago, when I kind of made these arguments, I felt pretty conspiracy theory nut. And then you see things like the Epstein files come out, and you're like, man, maybe there is a ruling class of billionaire pedophile elites who are running the world, you know? Like, so I think that there's a real kind of potential reckoning coming of where we recognize that there's a billionaire owning class who extract the value from everything, and they are dragons sitting on a hoard of wealth, and they are disrupting the gravity of our like society just by having this humongous glut of resources that, due to inflation, due to interest, is just infinitely gathering more momentum, and they are hoarding and sucking in more wealth every year, and that there is no tax, there is no like checks and balances we can do to this class, because they exist outside of the structure of politique. You know, they exist outside of our ability to govern people, because capital is the root of power in a capitalist economy. So that's one argument I have, and that we have to tear it down. We can't continue to.
Okay.
There's no fix under the capitalist system.
Do you want to then elaborate what's the way out?
That I'm less clear on. At times, I've considered communist lines to be an effective mode of operation. I'm not so sure that we can...
It doesn't seem to work out throughout the history, does it?
I think part of that has been limited by the influence of America's kind of imperial might. And, you know, you see every time a country moves towards communism or socialism, for example, Cuba, you see the largest economic power in the world militarily and economically sanction them into oblivion, so that they cannot import oil, they cannot import goods, they cannot get grain, they cannot survive and feed their people. And yes, if a small resource poor country implements socialist policies that benefit the workers, and then the largest military and economic power on the planet makes it a huge focus of their foreign policy to crush them, I'm sympathetic to it like working less effectively than you might hope. But for me, what's actually more problematic of the communist slide is that it seems to be very challenging to go from a capitalist society where people are fundamentally self-interested, where people are raised and educated and brought up in a society that values self-interest and values prioritizing the individual over the other, and then to transition into a communist style society, or a socialist towards communist, and then bring forward leaders who were grown in a capitalist environment, and then give them all this power, and find that they don't then are not tempted to like gather and hoard that power, and then end up becoming authoritarian in their disposition. And that then moves from like authoritarian from communism, which is fundamentally anti-authoritarianism, towards an authoritarian system, and like to have
like a pendulum swing,
exactly, or almost like a horseshoe. It's a small jump to go from, hey, we have a centrally planned economy run by a workers commune where everybody who is invested and like who works and builds and produces and adds value to the society gets their say and gets to promote and discuss and bring forth ideas and be involved in the running of the society. You're like, oh, that's perfect. And they're like, oh, but this is a lot of hassle because I've got farms to till and I've got, labor to do. Let's just get one guy, and like we'll get a couple guys, and we'll have one guy who's the chair. I guess the chair's making more decisions than he's running everything now. I feel like that's a really slippery slope, and so I find that challenging. So nowadays, I wonder if a more pragmatic kind of solve, at least in the kind of medium term, is more like a kind of social democracy style position, almost like state capitalist as well, like to bring, for me, I think a government of democratically elected peers into a much larger focus when running kind of economic affairs, bringing in really large taxation. I always, my favorite kind of statistic is the golden years in the UK and America, for example, were the 1960s, right? They had the largest economic boom in our country's like modern day history. They had the lowest levels of inequality. They had the largest levels of kind of GDP growth and social well-being and social mobility. These were the golden years, right? Do you know what the marginal upper rate of tax was in those years? In some places, it was above 90%. So, like, if you were earning in the top 1% of society, you were taxed at 90%. Like, that's pretty extreme. That's pretty socialist. That's pretty left-leaning, right? And those were some of capitalism's strongest growth years in recent history. So part of me would say that some kind of wealth tax towards elites and people with assets over $1 billion needs to be implemented, because there cannot be, in my opinion, a line at which you cross at which your assets accumulate more wealth than you need to live, and then they just infinitely self-perpetuate to increase on their value. If assets appreciate at a higher rate than inflation or interest because of the size of the asset, you can just infinitely buy more assets. That's a self-fulfilling black hole of economic value. You're just infinitely going to end up with bigger and bigger and bigger concentrations of wealth in very small hands. I think the government has a duty to step in and stop that from happening and go, okay, at a certain point you gain enough wealth and capital that you are sorted and your kids are sorted and your grandkids are sorted, we'll send you a big plaque that says, well done, you won capitalism, and everything that you make that over $1 billion is taxed at 99.999%. So that the wealth can't infinitely accumulate. You can get enough to be ungodly wealth. You can live like a king. You can have more wealth than any human being has ever had in the history of like pre-modern times. But you can't have wealth that infinitely self-perpetuates and sucks wealth out of every other part of society. If you do that, all the other parts of society stop working. We can't have an economic system that has infinite like money glitch holes at certain parts of the economy, which are also the most wealthy and powerful people in the economy. It doesn't function. So in a more realistic short-term policy approach, I'm a big tax the wealthiest assets and stop wealth from infinitely accumulating.
Do you think then, I assume, that you think the system can be fixed within the system?
I'm not convinced, but I don't. But like,
I guess there is no way to really prove it until...
Yeah.
Proving it.
And I think that as much as my kind of utopian idealism mind is like, oh, you know, revolution, bring in the wonderful, like, socialist republic, like, I don't think that's happening. I don't think that's a realistic goal. I don't think that's happening anytime soon, at the very least, like, in the next 150 years. And so I don't think it's a practical use of any politically interested person's time to sit and postulate how a revolution is going to happen if we had a completely different governmental system, if we reformed the voting system, if we changed the education standard of 99% of the population, if we completely redid the way we... Like, there's so much that would need to happen before that would even be a potential possibility. And even then, I'm not entirely sold that it would be a perfect solve. So in the medium to short term, I'm very much like, okay, let's work within the system as much as we can. I'm not convinced that it'll work, but maybe if we can plug the gaps effectively enough, maybe we can stop society from like just getting worse continually. Like, I don't know if you felt the same way, but like in the last 10 years, I just feel like every time I look at society, I'm like, oh wow, it's somehow just always getting worse. And I will make some small caveat to some kind of social gains. For me, kind of more kind of queer and LGBT rights and liberties and freedoms is a good thing. That's something I'm very positive. I see, you know, like, you know, equal marriage laws and stuff. I'm like, cool, that's nice. And it's nice, but for me, like, you can be you can be non-binary, you can be trans, you can have trans on your government ID, but if you can't get work, if you can't feed your family, if you can't pay your bills, I'm kind of like, look, is this really improving your material circumstances? So as much as I'm like there, I'm shouting for joy, I'm like, this is great, we should absolutely be campaigning and championing for these issues. Like,
it's like trying to plug a hole in a
little bit, and it's
Titanic.
Like, yeah, it's right. Like, okay.
Or no, rearranging the chairs.
And yeah,
the
yeah. It's
that's what they call
yeah.
it. Right?
We're getting good progress on these social issues, but we're neglecting good progress on these economic issues. And like, I think that some of the greatest inequalities done to people in society typically fall under class lines over gender and kind of identity lines. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I don't disregard that those are important and relevant and must be prioritised too. But for me,
so,
economic is the root.
Okay, so in that case, have you explored the topic of sound money? And money in part, like, what is money?
Mm.
Have you, because personally, I believe the root problem of what we're dealing with in the world, especially since 1971, is we have the world is using fake money.
Okay.
Money which is inherently broken.
After we moved off the gold standard.
Yeah. It happened earlier, but that was the last nail to the coffin, right? Personally, I don't think you can fix the system within the system, because the system requires more printing and more money supply creation, essentially taxing, essentially stealing from everyone who has, and especially those that have only money, which in general people do. You pointed out assets inflating in price as a problem. That's just a symptom, in my opinion, of the inherent problem of the money itself. It's almost like you're trying to measure, let's say that we have, you know, a meter, right? I work as a carpenter and I make tables by a meter, but every day my measure of meter is different.
Mm-hmm.
That's the system in which we live since 1971, and one would argue even more so since 1913, which was the first, you know, the Federal Reserve was created, and that was the first big blast, although the Bank of England was even earlier, but
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, 1971, and let's stick to that,
sure,
one, because
sure,
that's
sure.
Our experience.
Yeah,
my father
yeah.
Was born after that, and he perceives it to be normal.
Mm.
So in terms of politics, I have my opinions and stuff, but for the most part, so that's another thing. We have 4-year terms, right? So the way I perceive politics is it's a popularity contest. And the problem with that contest is it only incentivizes people for short-term solutions.
Yes.
It's almost as if you came in with a broken back.
Mm-hmm.
And because you're in pain, I'm going to give you painkillers, and
yeah.
That way you'll vote for me as you walk out the door, but
sure.
You still have a broken back.
Yeah.
So we are in this conundrum, which is why I'm curious, like, you know, can we really fix the system within the system? Because the system relies on printing more money, because people will not be happy when you tell them, oh, there is no more handouts, which effectively is what the government does. So where do we go from here, right? If the politicians are incentivized to just think about the next election, and no one's willing to do that sour pill swallowing of like, hey guys, so you know this money, we've been going on like this for a while and it's actually broken, and we've been fucking it up for generations, and now we have to either accept that we default on it, which effectively means we go bankrupt and then revalue whatever.
And you're never able to borrow again.
Or you kick the can down the road and pretend nothing happened because it's someone else's business, which effectively is what my perception of what... you said 10 years.
Mm.
I've been in the UK for 10 years. I came here because it was the land that offered more opportunities and better opportunities than Poland.
Which is crazy, because Poland's had such a run in the last 10 years.
It's literally...
Maybe you were the problem. Once he left.
Yeah, right. Once I'm gone, it'll be all good.
Okay, guys, let's get started.
Wojtek's gone, so... No, for real. So, it breaks my heart, because I really, like... I love the place.
Of course,
especially Edinburgh in particular. I could see having my life here as a thing. As we talked when we came in, I've never lived in Poland as an adult working. I'm more accustomed to a life of a, whatever you want to call it, a British-Polish man. But
maybe now's the time. Like, Poland's doing so well. Like, I keep thinking, sure, man, like, I'm losing the fucking UK.
I'm losing all the... Trump cards to bet against my wife and where we're gonna live.
because we
literally flipped to the point that I have friends that came here, lived here, are already back, and they're laughing at, like, yeah, you're still there, well, you know, let me know once you're back.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, you know, this is not to say that Poland has its own problems. It has inherently.
Sure.
It's on the same standard of money. It's just,
sure,
you know, in the past, in a sense.
And it's been making better fiscal decisions around within the context.
But yet again, like, from my perspective, until we fix that route, there is little to no political action I can see that will long term make things better. And I don't think anyone out there actually is willing to do that, because it's hard.
I definitely think, I don't know how much I can talk to the kind of fiat currency angle. That's not something I'm super knowledgeable in. But the term limit thing is really, like, 4 years is in a political sense not much time. But then, you know, it's something that I'd be very scared to, like, put
give
my
longer
voice behind to change. Because, like, you see, for example, Trump, right?
Mm.
He's been in 1 year. 1 year, and he has essentially destroyed the kind of world economic order and world kind of military order around accepting that America's the dominant kind of political power in the world, and everybody works in dollars and everything. You know, you see the fucking Iran blockade is charging in yuan. Like, you know, there's a shift coming.
I would as well.
Yeah, why not, right? It's kind of directly hitting them right in the pocket. But you see, you know, this breakdown of the Europe-America coalition, you know, the breakdown of this kind of Western hegemonic, like, imperial power that we were projecting over the rest of the world. Like, Mark Carney's speech about the middle powers coming together and having to really, like, recognize that in this massive polarized world where we've got China and Russia and America as being these back to almost Cold War superpowers, if these middle countries don't pick a side, we're basically picking between, like, insane dictators in one of three places. We need to find some kind of collection of middle powers that isn't just going to get trampled by this. I think that the UK has done a really poor job of finding its place in that. You know, it was like the worst possible time to hit a Brexit, you know. Like, it's like, yeah, guys, don't worry, we'll leave the EU and then we'll get good trade deals with America. Oh wait, they've elected that fucking orange maniac. Okay, cool, no worries, I'm sure that'll be fine. And then obviously our trade deals with America have been interesting, but America's been having a fucking massive
but to bring back the 4 year limit, So inherently, then, it's an issue, right? Because on one hand, you might get a crazy person in power, and 4 years is even too long.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, if you have only 4 years, even if you do get a good guy, he's all the incentives are aligned for him to do as much good as he can in those 4 years, because otherwise people will be like, okay, so this guy came in,
exactly,
he promised all, and this is the problem. Maybe, you know, slightly off topic from politics, but I think politics in essence is like the psychology of the world.
Groups,
it's like the delayed gratification.
Yeah,
and this is the problem of our lifetime.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Right now, among my friends, and I assume, you know, with the people we surround ourselves with, maybe we're skewed slightly more towards those that factor in delayed gratification as a goal.
A little bit, but it's still hard, isn't it? It's
still
hard.
Exactly. And that's inherently, I think, like a human issue in general, and then try to apply it to politics. The guy has his own life. Of course he's gonna do all he can for him and his family first. Sure. And if the inherent need is for you to be elected again in 4 years' time, well, surely you're not going to be risking pissing everyone off saying like, okay, what we do now in 20 years' time, we're going to have a fixed...
And it's so, you know, it's so difficult because, like, I don't even know that you need to just be a self-interested, like, person who then gets power and wants to look after his and his own sort of thing. I think it's just a reality of, like, if you want to make good, consistent changes over a 20-year period, you have to be elected for 20 consistent years. Because if you don't, like, if you don't get elected, that people are just going to walk it back. People are just going to run it back. And I think we're having, like, difficulties... you know, you, but then the flip side of it is you see things like the Tories getting in for basically 17 years straight, right? And it's like, okay, cool. Like, their goal then ended up not working, right? Because the goal was austerity, reduce the budget, bring the country back into a balanced budget, and then we can kind of progress with investment after that. It didn't work. The budget's higher than the deficit's higher than it's ever been. Like, it's an...
Because that's the feature, not the bug.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
Yeah. That's how that money works. That's
exactly.
My point.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, if you were to take, like, a super Keynesian approach to it, for example, and be like, yo, this 4 years, we're going to blow the budget apart. We're going to do so much investment in infrastructure that in 20 years, we're going to see incredible fruits from, you know, we're going to invest in the roads, invest in power, invest in green power grid that is going to, you know, survive oil shocks in the future. It's not going to be finished. We're just going to have... You know, in 8 years, we'll have masses of unfinished construction projects.
You know, that's exactly what happened to in Poland, actually. Yeah. They came up with this project, which I assume, and, you know, don't quote me on this, but inherently, I believe there is a risk of corruption wherever. Sure. It's just a matter of, if people don't have enough strong morals, they will fall for it. But they came up with this central airport in the central Poland, which was supposedly going to be like this huge, you know, our Frankfurt am Main vibe, Schiphol, you know, a big project. They sunk loads of money into it. They did like 2 or 3 years of construction, effectively just raising, you know, concrete stuff. Yeah. And then, we're actually not going to do it. A new, a new government is in power.
Yeah, and they don't
and
like
that's
it.
That.
Yeah, HS2 is a great example as well.
Yeah, no problem. You know, of course, the money that was used is yours because it's not like the government is producing money,
but
that's okay. Yeah. Have you ever tried to spend someone else's money? It's the easiest thing in the world. I promise you, I was given pocket money from my parents. Oh man, it just goes. It's like the easiest choice ever.
Yeah. And then you look at China, and they do have a centrally planned kind of infrastructure project, and they don't have term limits. Well, they do have technically term limits, but functionally not. And they, over 20 years, have done just the most incredible infrastructure project you've ever seen, and it's done incredible.
So we're inherently at disadvantage from an authoritarian regime,
simply
because we're not authoritarian.
Yeah.
Oh, well, monarchy, let's come back. Jarvis, Jarvin is a guy who talks about the idea that the best way is to go back to monarchy. Like, that's the only long-term option there.
See, like, I find myself really struggling with this because I recognize from an economic planning perspective, a 20-year plan is so much more efficient than a 4-year one. But on the flip side, I'm like, I couldn't, like, in good conscience, say, let's get rid of people's ability to vote. Let's get rid of actual effective democracy. But the problem is people tend to not be like people are very vulnerable to propaganda and can fall for poor economic choices and poor policy decisions just by good marketing. So I guess we find ourselves in a little bit of a bind where it's like, how do you actually make long-term solve? And I think the fucking elephant in the room that we haven't spoken about is climate change. Like, what's bigger, like, long-term, suffer now for benefits in the future example is there other than climate change? And what have we done about it? Fucking notes! We've done barely anything.
Well, yeah, but imagine, good luck trying to do anything about anything long-term if we cannot really... So,
exactly.
To make it a bit more actionable then, because we are dealing with it, right? Mm. Both me and you are dealing with life on life's terms right now. You even more so than me, considering that you believe there is no other life, right?
Yeah.
What's
my one shot?
What can you do about it? Like, what do you do about it? Because, you know, our listeners, on average, my listener is somewhere between 27 and 34, 40 years old. And most of them are from the United States, UK and Poland, which is no surprise, I think. What do you do as a person interested in this, apart from, you know, hopefully not losing sleep overnight about it? Like, what do you do on the daily basis to ensure that you are okay and your family's okay?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, like, important to, like, we have to use the levers of power that are available to us. So we have to vote. Like, it may feel pointless, it may feel useless, it may feel difficult, but, like, there have been periods of large improvement in America, in Poland, in the UK, in the past. And it was because governments got in with large mandates and large and a clear vision, and they had a huge amount of political power and were able to make changes.
They actually delivered.
Yeah, exactly. And that's rare and challenging and not guaranteed, but that is the only immediate lever of power we have access to us that isn't going to take, you know, the rest of your life. You know, you do it 5 minutes on a Sunday morning, whatever.
Every 4 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think that's a first port of call. And the other thing is, I think, like, building, I think it's really hard to make those kind of choices in low trust societies, right? So if we have a world where we believe that politicians are out to get us and they're just here to, like, you know, line their own pockets and fuck off, like, that's not really a society in which we could ever move towards somewhere where people go, hey, look, we have a long-term plan, it's going to suck in the short term, but we're investing in the long term. So I think little things that you can do in your own life is to try and move your world and your space into a more high trust environment. So being authentic, acting with dignity, acting with character, trying to create situations and places and society and parts of your world where you act with authority and integrity and are honest and upfront and clear with people, and create spaces where people feel connected to their local community, people feel invested in the people around them, people feel secure and happy, and they feel that there is an element of their life that is getting better in some way. And if you can be involved in spaces like that, and especially if you find yourself in a situation like me, where I am in some capacity like an authority figure in the gym, right? Like,
sure.
The way that I act, the way that I involve other people in this project, I think is important to show that, you know, maybe even as simple as, like, authority inherently isn't corruptive, you know, it's like, or that
you can get away with being a nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And but then also just to create those spaces where, you know, and to kind of talk almost more in terms of my individual politics, like, to create spaces where people see people of other cultures and backgrounds and practices and belief systems and like ways of doing life, and can have a conversation and can have a chat and be like, oh, you know, this person from another part of the world who I am being told hates me and my way of life, he's such a nice guy, you know, let's go have a meal together, or like to create spaces where people can kind of move past this, like, politics of hate and division and move towards a recognition that people are just trying to get by. Most people are good people. People want to connect. People want to work together. And maybe if we all do that and we create a big space of that, maybe, you know, when someone comes on the TV and says, listen, don't worry about those billionaires who are extracting your wealth, it's that brown guy who lives next door to you who's the problem. Maybe when that guy comes on the TV, you go, I know the brown guy who lives next door to me, and he's a lovely guy. You know, I don't think he is ruining my country. I think it's, you know, like, you know, what are you, you know, you, the lady doth protest too much. What are you hiding? You know, maybe if we can create a society where we trust each other and we like each other and we know each other, we can move away from this kind of scapegoating of the weakest and most vulnerable people in our societies and move towards a collective idea of, like, no, actually, we have more in common than, like, you and your, like, brown mate have more in common as normal working people who live in this world than some billionaire on a yacht. Like, that if we can find community and alliances within ourselves and between ourselves, maybe we can work together to create a world that is less divisive. And I think that that's what we can do in our day-to-day.
You know, I think you fit in perfectly in terms of what you said earlier, as a, you're purpose, let's say.
Yeah.
So that's definitely up there in integrity.
I try. I don't always get it right, but I try.
Sure. Yeah. We're all faulty at some point. The thing that really struck me as like, this is basically everyone's lived experience if they care to go outside. It's like, as you said, majority of people and majority of the world is much better than what is being portrayed in the news or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't think many of our listeners watch the news to begin with, because I think the news is the relic of the past in general. Hopefully they get sources and then they think critically, otherwise they wouldn't really be interested in such a conversation to begin with.
Yeah.
But this is the lived experience I have in general. It's like, the best way to see how people are is just to have a little chat.
Yeah.
And maybe the flip side of it, and the problematic part is, and I assume you don't really do much social media, if you allow that social media to become your oracle in a sense, it can get really harsh really quick, right?
Yeah,
and this is the frustration that I have in general with some of my colleagues, and not only that, there is, as you said, like there is a really vibrant potential for just scaring yourself away from people by watching the Black Mirror again and again, showing you all kinds of horrific stuff. And probably I've had Nathan on the show a while back, and one thing that he said is like, switch off the screen and go outside, right? It's like, touch some grass.
Yeah.
Just become human again, in a sense, talk to people, have a community. So yeah, 100%, you know, roots sort of maybe roots up.
Grassroots,
it might not fix the system, but at least it will fix the immediate life around you to the point that you're living in a better world.
And maybe that could then have knock-on effects. You know, imagine if we had 20 years, instead of 20 years of like conservative austerity politics, imagine if we'd had 20 years of like a government that was really focused on reducing inequality and thinking about long-term investments. If that was the general zeitgeist of British voting electorates, maybe we'd be in a different place. Maybe not. Maybe we would end up in similar money traps and the power of big capital and the fact that we're only one country of many hundreds that is trying this. You know, maybe it wouldn't. But I struggle to imagine that it would be substantively like worse if we as a society were much more considerate and caring towards people in our immediate communities, and when we were voting for people for who had a vision of society, if we were voting for people who generally were like, hey, people are good people, we welcome people, we want people to work together, we want like a community and society that is kind of supportive and tolerant and compassionate. I can't imagine it would create something that much worse. So, I mean, maybe I'm naive on that front.
Well, you know, it's if there is no hope, then what are we trying to do, right? Yeah. I would add to your script of things, fixing the money. And I genuinely mean that, and I think it is doable. I don't think it's easy. And I think the stack is sort of, you know, set up against that. But as you said, with grassroots, I do believe in the same way, and I fully subscribe to the idea that, you know, there is this, in general, in long term, and I think this is one of the ways in which the world is as it is right now and people don't care to change it. If you're struggling to make your ends meet, it is very unlikely for you to care about the person next door about whatever, you know, changes are happening in the world.
Yeah.
Because you're just chasing your own tail trying to pay the bills. And if the system is designed for you to exactly do that because of its inherent flaws, then I believe one of the ways to make the world better long term is for you to opt out from that system, or at least to secure yourself out of the system's terms, which for example means don't get a mortgage, don't get a credit, instead consider to educate yourself about sound money principles and where can you put your capital, which effectively is what, you know, your savings, to make sure that you are independent. And and if I'm independent of my boss threatening me to do something, because I can quit, then I am actually independent. Otherwise, I'm not really independent. I can tell myself that I am, but if I need to go to work regardless, if my boss is a prick.
Exactly. You're not really stuck. A free market if people cannot leave their work.
Exactly.
Know?
Yeah. So I would just add that as a prescription in general that I hope. And you've explored, you've been to Costa Rica, which is really curious for me.
Yeah.
I know both Costa Rica and Salvador by now accept Bitcoin as a means of payment. Have you had a chance of exploring that while you were there? Did you go to any mercados and stuff?
Yeah. I'm not into crypto stuff. I'm too phobic of the risk. Like, it's very volatile. But it was interesting to see that, like, that was an option that you could pay with in some
places.
They did
mention it.
Yeah, there was a couple of places. But not something I've super delved into. But I think it's like, as you said there, it basically ends up becoming that, like, social justice and social change becomes a purview of the middle classes. Because if you're not in the middle class, you don't have the freedom, the time to be considering
resources.
To dedicate to it. And I'm very sympathetic to that. But then it kind of leads to this difficulty where social justice then becomes the purview of the middle class. And it becomes then a very middle class social justice, you know, where it is focused on things like, labeling and word use and language and stuff. And it's not focused on things like destitution and, modern day slavery by being forced into wages and work that you don't have any other option for. And I think that's something that's challenging to fix, but should be brought into focus as well. You know, like you say, you've got to fix the money. And if you can't, give any thought to anything other than where your next paycheck is coming from, of course you're not going to be political.
And this is to the detriment of every discourse and everything, right? Like, if I know that the elections are coming, but I have only an hour a week, hopefully, to actually contribute to learn about what is on the table,
it's going to be hard.
Then you just attend. Someone screams at you a slogan, and you're like,
Stop the bus.
You know, whatever, and that's that.
And I think as well, it's even worse than that, because the groups in society that are the most able to spend their time thinking about these things are people who are financially, like, liberated, and typically that's the older generation, which skews heavily in certain political directions. And, you know, you hear these insane stories of people campaigning around the UK and, like, spending more time in nursing homes than they do on university campuses, you know?
Campaigning?
Yeah, like, going around and just only speaking to pensioners.
Well, because
they're the ones who vote.
So there are inherent flaws anyway in the... Yeah.
But those flaws are so ridiculous to me because, like...
How do you...
Like, if you're 25, brother, you can find the time. You can find the time to go and vote. Like, it's literally going to take you 10 minutes.
Yeah, but not 10 minutes because you need to ideally, you should probably think a few minutes more. You know,
well, my hope is that if we had 99% voter turnout in under 25s, like, maybe then more political campaigning and effort would be put towards outreach to them.
What was the previous one? Do you remember?
It was like in the low 40s, I think. It was like really poor. You know, like,
yeah, but then, like, coming back to what we explored earlier, I think it's the same problem as, like, how much percentage of it, again, were skewed because we do it.
Sure.
How many people in our age work out regularly?
Sure.
Probably around 40 people, 40%, So it's this problem that, like, you said, brother, you have time to do it. Everyone does, but they don't.
Yeah.
They just watch the, you know, hopefully not the news, but they watch something to numb themselves. They're chasing their own tail. They don't think about savings and investings because, like, oh yeah, I'm just partying. And I think, as you said, bread and circuses, it's essentially, like, whether it was put in place to do so or whether it just emerged or something, it's a bit of, like, whatever. The fact is, it just is there and is participating. So it is, I don't think there is a much way out in terms of, like, social change broadly. I'm curious to see the elections next time, because, as you said, like, we're living through
Yeah.
Curious times.
Curious times indeed. And we've got the Scottish elections coming up soon.
Yeah, and in Dobbs I can actually vote.
Oh yeah, let's go. That's so cool.
I got a little letter saying like, after all these years. All right, man, whatever.
Ah, can be honest.
don't blame it on me when you don't like the I'm going to be back in Poland. Like.
Yeah, mail in.
Yeah, so no, but yeah. Curiouser and curiouser. Now, brother, we've been going on for quite some time, which I think is it just shows what we're interested in, what you are interested in particular. So, usually, as part, and we'll definitely have another episode at some point because we just opened like a kind of random stuff.
Quite a few cans of worms.
Always with my guests at the very end, we either unpack or maybe they offer our listeners, you know, maybe something that you've been thinking recently about, or maybe there is a certain, you've already told us about your life philosophy in a sense, so maybe, you know, skip that. Maybe there is some sources or some activities, something that you would encourage them to explore. Maybe you want to say hi to Phoebe, you know, whatever it is, it's like your space. Whatever we've not unpacked, or whatever you would like to share, or you've just stumbled upon a nice slogan, you know what I mean? Like, whatever you'd like to explore, maybe, in this last, like, 10 minutes of our...
Interesting, yeah. I don't know, I guess, like, on this kind of... on this politics stuff, I do think it's important to have hope, to recognise that if we just move into a nihilistic, like, it'll never get better, nothing will ever change... perspective, like nothing will ever change. You know, you have to maintain hope even if it feels futile. And so I think it's important for people to try and to do that. I used to know a lot of people who were in that very much like nothing ever happens camp. It's like, you know, we vote for one,
like nothing ever changes.
We vote for one party, nothing happens. We vote for another, nothing happens. I feel like it's been a bad few years for the Nothing Ever Happens crew, you know? Like, a lot of things are happening, you know? The world really can change in a very short period of time, you know? Slowly, slowly, and then all at once, right? And so I think it's important to recognise that just because it's been getting worse recently, it can also get better, and to try and keep hoping that stuff. And I think that goes for so many different parts of your life, you know? Like, if you allow yourself to slip into... nihilism without tempering it with absurdism or existentialism, you become apathetic and you do nothing, and then nothing, and then truly nothing happens, whether that's in terms of your physical health, you know, your body, you're like looking after your health and well-being, whether that's in terms of getting through some trying time, you're sat on the hospital floor bleeding out your head, or in my case sat in a fucking chemo ward with a needle in your arm. Like, you have to maintain hope to change your circumstance, because otherwise nothing will change. And even if that's in terms of, you know, your jiu-jitsu, you know, when you're stuck in that sweaty brown belt spot on side control, you have to maintain hope, because otherwise nothing's gonna change.
I guess that's a nice tie-in. You know, on that front, like, yeah, hope for sure. I argued with one of my friends at some point, discussed the idea that you either choose hope or death, in essence, right? If you're not hoping, then what are you doing? Like, you're waiting? Or, like, just
call it there. Whatever, like.
But in that sense, I guess the point that I'd like to make for our listeners is, like, yeah, just educate yourselves. Like, I feel that over the course of our conversation, I've gotten to know you, apart from maybe a few episodes I've heard, I've gotten to know you much more from an aspect that I've not had a chance at jiu-jitsu, because for good reason, you should probably not be, you know, advertising politics as part of your class. It's like, it's a no-no.
Yeah,
it's something
that
you explore in a private setting, right? Or at least on the street. Get outside with a mat. You know, this is side control, and have you thought about
it? Maybe not while I'm getting paid. But stay on topic, Ronan.
But like, it's the point you made earlier, like, it's all about just listening to sources, reading podcasts, people, to understand the world better, and at least to see the other perspectives, so you can have a bit more like a meaningful engagement with it, right?
Yeah, agreed. Like, and I think when you're doing that, it's important to be discerning, obviously, and to recognize that, like, especially if you're like always reading, always listening to podcasts, always online, and someone is telling you to like not trust your neighbor, to be distrustful of your local community, to that there is someone who is like a vulnerable group in society who is your enemy. They're probably trying to get you to look past something. Like, it has almost never been the case that the problem is in society weak and vulnerable and poor people in your communities and societies, you know.
And to that point, you can't really discern whether or not someone, what they're saying in a 3-second video, if you don't know them. Whereas, you know, if we meet up and you start telling me all those things, at least personally, I do believe that there is a certain level of heightened awareness when we are engaging with one another that allows us to be a bit more aware.
Yeah, unless smell a rat better.
Yeah. Unless you're in a crowd, and then crowdthink comes into play, and starts burning churches or whatever. But like, you know, one to one, it's much more difficult to lie to a person or to gaslight someone, and you feel it everywhere. Even people who are really good at lying, ultimately they have to switch their environments every now and then because you get so convoluted with your lies.
Yeah.
Imagine how, like, this is another kind of word. Like, imagine how complex it is to live a life of constant lies. You literally have to remember everything.
My memory is nowhere near good enough for that.
You know
I'm authentic because I cannot keep a story straight.
You know, I think it was Mark Twain who said that someone who tells the truth all the time doesn't have to remember what they said.
Yeah. You know? It's great.
Because, like, ultimately, who cares? You just said it. Yeah, whatever. Like, yeah.
My belief slightly changed in the last 5 years, but it's probably on the same guy. Yeah, exactly. It's much easier that way.
Yeah, for sure. And it will change. You know, we've had a discussion now. Let's say that we have another episode in a year or two.
Yeah.
There will be some other stuff that we're going to explore. Yeah, maybe some of the things we've explored, we're going to be like, oh, by the way, I found out this. And
I aged like milk.
You know, like, yeah. Well, hopefully not. But
well, that's it.
Whatever.
You must maintain hope.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have hope, like, then the outcome is you're totally nihilistic about it all. And in that case, we'll all be dead, so who cares?
Yeah, but the point is still, at least we stuck to telling the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
And in the future, if someone asks us what did we talk about, we're not going to have to come up with a story about those things. We're just going to be like, oh, yeah, I actually said that. That's a bit stupid.
Yeah.
Which is not surprising. Like, me now, hopefully, if I'm growing, if I'm maintaining that, you know, development of some sort, and I'm not dying, in 2 years, 3 years, 4 years time, hopefully I will be slightly smarter, right?
That's always the hope. Turns out, though, if you do jiu-jitsu all the time, you get loads of concussions, it goes the other way.
Still better than American football.
True. I was a lot smarter 5 years ago.
But yeah, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, guys, I'll put in the link below also a conversation that Ronan had with Rami on another show. I've been on Rami's show before, and it's definitely worth your while. If you want to learn about Ronan's journey, especially maintaining such an optimistic mindset during the tough times, we sort of skimmed through it,
That other podcast goes a bit more into depth about the cancer stuff.
So didn't you do also
Ross.
So I'll put also Ross's one.
Cool.
And Rami.
That's very kind of you.
Yeah, because basically the point is, like, you know, whoever is listening and they're like, okay, this guy's either crazy or cool, at least they can explore even more, right? They have plenty to explore. Other than that, make sure to click, you know, follow, subscribe, whatever you do. It helps, honestly. That's like taking a vote. It basically sends me either, you know, up and down kind of Caesar sign. And thank you so much for listening.
Boom. Hell yeah.